This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour. We have our panel of trumpet writers here, eager and ready to discuss the important events of this past week. In the studio here, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Always great to be here.
And Sam Livingston is with us.
Happy to be here.
And from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
We have a load of interesting stories for you on today's program. We're going to start in the Middle East. The Islamic State is suffering some serious defeats, and many analysts are saying that this terrorist organization is actually approaching its demise. Now, that would be good news, except it does come with some alarming side effects. One is that the forces fighting against the Islamic State include Syria's Bashar Assad, the terrorist group Hezbollah, and Iran. The declining threat from the Islamic State means that these forces are likely to begin turning their attention elsewhere, specifically toward their longtime arch enemy, Israel. For this story, we're going to turn to Sam.
Thank you. Well, this week, the mosque in Mosul, where the Islamic State announced its caliphate in 2014, was captured by the Iraqi military. And now ISIS is being pushed out of Mosul, and their last stronghold is in Raqqa, Syria. So as you said there at the top, ISIS appears to be on the down and out. And this whole battle to eradicate the Islamic State has caused, or the upshot of this, is exactly what the Trumpet said would happen 2 to 3 years ago, that the Islamic State was more of a distraction, and it has paved the way for Iran to take over large swaths of the Middle East. They're now fully entrenched in Iraq. They are in Syria and now Lebanon as well. Hezbollah in Lebanon is obviously alongside them for this fight. For the duration of this war, Israel was sitting on the sideline. They were happy to watch Hezbollah and Iran lose thousands of troops fighting the rebels in Syria, fighting the Islamic State in Iraq. I think Hezbollah may have lost between 4,000 and 6,000 troops. Iran, I think, lost over 4,000 as well. So Israel was happy to see its two enemies just, you know, wasting their time battling each other, more or less. But now that Iran and that Shiite axis appears to be succeeding, they're now turning their sights on Israel. The main region Israel is concerned about in Syria is this region right next to the Golan Heights. It's called the Daraha region. And there's been sporadic rocket fire from this area in the past, just from the Syrian civil war coming in over or spilling over into Israel. But now Hezbollah and Iran may have a more calculated assault in the works. The leader of Hezbollah recently said, his name is Hassan Nasrallah, he is calling for a Shiite army to amass, calling in soldiers from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from Iran, from Iraq, to convene to attack Israel. He says they could amass a force of over 100,000 soldiers. The Ayatollah has made similar statements saying that now our focus needs to be on liberating Palestine. We need to focus all of our attention on fighting Israel. And then recently, this came out this week, where Lebanon, these flags started appearing on the border between Lebanon and Israel. The Iranian flag is appearing over there. Hezbollah flags are popping up over there. Then there's a billboard with the Dome of the Rock with the Ayatollah's face right next to it. And then in Hebrew and Arabic, it says, "We are coming." It's nothing new there. But now that the Islamic State distraction, more or less, is out of the way, that axis of Shiite militias will be able to now focus on who's always been their primary enemy, Israel.
How credible is the threat, say, of Nasrallah and Hezbollah being able to rally large groups of Arabs or Muslims from the surrounding territory?
Well, they can provoke all they want, but the reality of it is that Hezbollah is funded by Iran. They're not really going to be able to call any of the shots. They obviously can open up that corridor between Lebanon and Israel. But primarily, this is going to have to come from Iran wanting to amass this force. I mean, it's calling in troops from Afghanistan, from Pakistan. I mean, Hezbollah's army has been decimated from helping Bashar al-Assad, and they can talk and talk about it all they want, but the reality of it is it's going to have to come from Iran, and they appear willing to do it, but it might be a little while for them to just recover from the battle that they've been in, but there's plenty of time to amass that force if they want to.
Well, we've definitely been talking about just how much Iran has been using the threat of the Islamic State, or you use that as somewhat of a foil for its own, to advance its own interest in the region, and how now we're entering this new period where, as the Islamic State power wanes, that we're likely to see Iran make bolder moves to assert itself, and we've seen this kind of back and forth between the United States and Iran in Western Syria, and it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds with this kind of very bold rhetoric coming from Hezbollah. As you said, it probably has been very much empowered by Iran to do that, and it seems like it gives us an indication of where this situation might go in the time ahead. We'll definitely keep our eyes on it. We appreciate that, Sam. We have been tracking the tensions between the United States and Asia in recent months, and the situation isn't getting any better. This week, there were multiple signs that animosity between the Trump administration and China is growing. For this, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, several developments happened this week showing that the U.S.-China relationship is coming under some pretty heavy strains once again, and it could unravel pretty quickly and possibly even slide into a trade war. First of all, on Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi held their maiden meeting. This was at the White House. And during this meeting, Mr. Modi really seemed to be vying with China for Mr. Trump's favor in the region. And so these two, Mr. Trump and Mr. Modi, made a big, almost theatrical show of their fondness for each other. There was a big and prolonged bear hug to start things
right.
off.
And it seemed like that was Modi initiating that. He just kind of glommed onto him.
Yes, that's right. And then the two of them, you know, Mr. Trump lavished the most lavish praise you could imagine on Mr. Modi and vice versa. And
so that really was trying to send a message to China, you think?
Exactly. Yeah, this was all just to sort of show China that since Trump is disappointed that China has not helped the U.S. apply pressure on North Korea to curb its illegal nuclear and missile programs, Mr. Trump is now moving on. He tweeted not long ago, "While I greatly appreciate the efforts of President Xi and China to help with North Korea, it has not worked." And so now he's moving on. And right around the same time as this meeting with Modi, the U.S. also approved the sale of some very advanced drones to India, which India is expected to use to spy on Chinese naval movements in the Indian Ocean. And it's the first time these drones have ever been sold to a non-NATO country. And then the two also affirmed their commitment to participate in a huge joint naval drill in the Indian Ocean coming up in July. So just by cozying up to one of China's real regional allies there, India, the U.S. is showing that it's just ready to move on and that it's tired of China not really applying pressure on North Korea. So that was Monday. And then on Thursday, the U.S. State Department approved weapons sales to Taiwan. This was the first sale of weapons to Taiwan by the U.S. since Trump came into power. And Taiwan is probably the most sensitive area in all of China's foreign policy because China sees Taiwan as a part of its territory and it plans to probably take it back by force someday if it has to. So for China to see the U.S. selling Taiwan $1.4 billion in new weapons would have just really angered the Chinese almost as nothing else could. And then also on Thursday, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on a Chinese bank, a Chinese shipping company, and two Chinese individuals because these entities and individuals were engaged in business with North Korea. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are sanctions in place that say no one can do business with North Korea right now. These are designed to try to pressure the North into curbing its illegal weapons programs. And so these Chinese companies have ignored those sanctions. And now Trump is saying, well, guess what? Now you're sanctioned too. So when you put all this together, it really was a rough week for the U.S.-China relationship. And now there's also a very good possibility that Mr. Trump will put tariffs on Chinese steel, which would be quite a big deal. And it all just sets the stage for China-U.S. relations to possibly come all the way apart.
You really could view all of these things as being aimed at China, the sale to Taiwan, the relationship with India. Obviously, these sanctions, Donald Trump really seems to be treating the North Korea threat as one of the biggest problems facing his administration, and is putting a lot of pressure on China to help to bring that problem under control. China doesn't seem to be too interested in cooperating to any tremendous degree.
That's right. They have attempted to cooperate, at least in a way that appears to be cooperation, but it hasn't been meaningful enough to convince Trump that China's serious about it. And so it seems that Mr. Trump is now saying, well, that tactic isn't working, and it really looks like a military option could be on the table for the Trump administration to deal with the North.
How much leverage does China have to beat back these aggressive moves by the Trump administration?
Well, it's difficult to say. China is an export economy, very dependent on the U.S. buying all of its goods. So in a way, the U.S. has a lot of leverage there. But it's hard to say how that would pan out.
So the trade relationship, you were talking about just putting more pressure on China over its steel exports. Where might that situation lead to?
Well, it would be up to a 20% tariff imposed on Chinese steel. So it would just represent a major blow to that sector in China's economy. But it could also be a big boon to U.S. steel manufacturing, which has suffered immensely in the last few decades.
You were talking about leverage, that it is really complicated between the relationship between the United States and China, because, as you mentioned, obviously the Chinese economy is very dependent on exports to the United States. But at the same time, the American economy is extremely dependent on China continuing to buy our treasury bonds. Mm-hmm. They hold close to $1 trillion, maybe even over $1 trillion. It's been a little bit since I've checked dollar reserves in their bank, that as they start dumping more of those, could really push the dollar's reserve currency into huge question and lead to massive inflation in the United States. So in a lot of ways, they kind of both China and America have a gun to each other's head. Mm-hmm. And they either cooperate or see who has the guts to move first to try to break this up. So that does make it a pretty tricky balancing act that both the Trump administration and the Chinese government's playing here.
Yeah. A delicate and complicated relationship, and we appreciate you bringing us up to speed on those latest developments. It'll be interesting to see how China responds to that. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to catch up now with the latest on the banking crisis in Europe, specifically in Italy. We talked about the trouble facing Italy's sixth largest bank a couple of weeks ago. Developments this week were considerably more alarming than that. The Italian government announced it would bail out two struggling banks, up to 17 billion euros. To tell us about this and the implications it has for Italy and for the euro, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, and there's a couple of big takeaways from what we just saw. And the first is, this really is a significant addition to Italy's debt. You know, Italy's government debt is a big problem. Their economy hasn't really been growing, which means this debt burden has basically been essentially just been getting bigger and bigger. And the total bill for the bailout, like you said, 17 billion, that's about the same that Italy spends on defense. Each year. So it's a significant number. It's about 1% of its economy. It tips their debt to about 133%, I think, of their GDP. So it's not going to put them immediately in insolvency. However, this is the kind of time during the economic cycle where typically, nations should be lowering their debt, getting rid of their debt, so that they have have room to, just in case there's a rainy day, just in case there's an emergency, so they can respond to that. Instead, you saw a massive jump in the Italian government's debt. So rather than immediate insolvency being the problem, the big question is more like, okay, well, what kind of a position does this put Italy in when a crisis hits, when something really big does, or even bigger does happen, seeing as they're having to kind of spend this right now. But then the second big takeaway is just that this was another major test for Europe's new banking resolution mechanism. This is what we talked about a few weeks ago when Spain had to sell off one of their banks to Santander, and you know, people were kind of watching that as the first big test of these resolution mechanisms, and basically they kind of found a way to skirt around those new rules. And so all eyes were focused on Italy to see, okay, well, is this new banking resolution mechanism going to work? And what we saw instead was that they just kind of skirted around what they found is they found a loophole, and they found an excuse, some small print, to not apply the new banking resolution mechanism. They basically said that in one case that they needed to avoid economic disturbance in this region in Italy, and also they said that the banks were too small, too insignificant to be a systemic risk, and therefore the rules didn't apply.
So had the rules applied, what would the how would this have unfolded?
Right. Well, really, the way it's all worked out is kind of the worst possible of all the world, all the worlds. Really, it was the rules themselves that caused this crisis, that caused the banks even to get to this position, because the rules say that if a bank goes bust, people with large deposits in the bank lose their money. And people with these large deposits, they have to lose their money before the government can get involved mm-hmm. and lose taxpayers' money. And that ruling in a lot of ways caused it to get to this position. They were troubled, but as soon as that became the policy, well, what's your response? You think, well, I'm going to take my money right away out of any risky banks.
Sure.
And so these banks went from being slightly risky banks to needing a bailout. Since June 2015, they lost nearly half of their deposits into these two banks. Mm-hmm. That's what really caused this problem. So the new rules caused the problem, and then when it comes time to fix them, then they turn around and say, well, actually, depositors aren't going to lose any money, and the government bail it out. Now, if they'd have said this 2 years ago, the problem wouldn't have even reached this stage.
Yeah.
And so... Well, it's just another example of how the EU's really muddled approach to the whole euro crisis is actually causing the crisis to get worse.
Well, how much tension does this increase the relationship between Italy and the rest of the eurozone? How has the market responded? How are other European officials responding to the Italian government's decision here?
Well, Europe had to sign off on this. Italy could not do this without getting the European Union's permission and the permission of the European Central or the bank and the economists there. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard basically said that the way they were doing this shows that the EU is now seriously alarmed by the political undercurrents in Italy. Basically, the European Union and officials there are realizing, if we force ordinary Italian depositors and pensioners to take the hit here, we're going to make ourselves even more unpopular. There are elections coming up in Italy. Some polls a few months ago basically showed that a coalition of parties that wanted Italy out of the euro could gain a majority. That those parties have done less well in more recent polls, but there's still the very real risk that if they allowed these banks to follow through with the resolution mechanism right now, then they could have had an unfavorable result in the Italian election, being faced with a possibility of quitterly, mm-hmm. Italy leaving. And so that's why they had to compromise. Now, on the other hand, though, this has made Germany very upset. Well, a little peeved, I guess. Very upset is probably a bit of an exaggeration in the run-up to a German election, because now the Germans aren't happy right. that the rules that they put in place haven't been followed. And they've been, you know, the German members of the European Central Bank and economists have been criticizing this, because if the Italian government does need a bailout at some point down the line, some of that money is going to have to come from Germany. So definitely there's still tension there. And it was a symptom of that tension that they had to let these banks out of the resolution, standard resolution mechanism in the first place.
There's this consistent tension. We saw it play out in Greece. We've seen it in Spain. And we see it here in Italy, between the need for austerity measures and tightening of the belt to, in order to make things more sustainable in the long run, and the absolute unwillingness of the people in these countries to do that, and the way that they'll lash out against any politicians or bankers who would exact those measures against them. And the net effect of everything is that the problem just becomes greater, and it gets pushed down the road for a little ways, but the day of reckoning is just going to be that much more painful when it finally arrives. So it is interesting to see this unfolding here in Italy. I'm sure you'll keep us abreast of the further developments. We do appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We have one more story here before we take a quick break. The Roman Catholic Church has faced its share of sexual abuse scandals in recent decades across several countries. Well, now one of Pope Francis's closest advisors is taking a leave from the Vatican to fight a number of sexual assault charges in his home country of Australia. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is something that just broke yesterday, is that Cardinal George Pell was charged by Australian police with multiple sexual abuse charges. Like as you mentioned, the Pope has given him leave to a leave from work to go home and defend himself against these charges. And we'll see in the coming weeks whether he's actually guilty of the things he's been accused of or not. But regardless of that, this is just a really huge scandal, especially in the Australian Catholic Church, which has had a horrible history, even compared to other countries, of priests abusing young children. Actually, Cardinal Pell himself, when he first became a bishop in Melbourne back in 1996, had faced court charges before, not of abusing children himself, but of covering for up to 55 priests under his jurisdiction who were. And the Australian government's revealed that just in the past four decades, there's been almost 4,500 children who've brought forth sexual abuse claims by up to 7% of the priests in Australia. And so this is kind of something with like one of the lead cardinals in Australia being charged of doing this himself after he's already been in court for covering those who have in his jurisdiction. It is just something that looks obviously really bad for those thousands of children who have been abused by priests in the Australian Catholic Church.
How significant is it that this is someone who's so close to the Pope?
Well, it is because obviously Cardinal Pell is on the Council of Cardinal Advisors. It's like they've called it like the Vatican, like the equivalent of the Vatican G8. There's actually nine, but these are like the nine closest men to the Pope. And so he's definitely one of the 10 most powerful men in the Catholic Church, the highest profile figure to date that these charges have come against. On that standpoint, I mean, it even puts more of like a global perspective on this. This is obviously not a problem that's just happened in Australia. There's been I think like 3,400 priests who've either been defrocked or sent to live in a monastery for the rest of their life because of sexual molestation. Then that's roughly 1% of all the priests there are. And Pope Francis actually a couple years back even leaked that he thought the problem, he called sexual abuse a leprosy infecting the priesthood. He even suggested that it could be worse. It could be up to 2%. Of the priests, like 8,000 priests in the Catholic Church who have been involved in this kind of behavior. Cardinal Pell, being on the council that's supposed to be advising the Pope on how to deal with issues like this, if he's actually one of the ones that's a problem, I mean, that is a problem that could have some global impact.
Mm-hmm. It's an alarming story. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about the 20th anniversary of the Hong Kong handover, the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. We'll also talk about Google receiving the largest fine in European Union history, and a look at the effects of Seattle's $15 minimum wage. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We have a couple stories about historical anniversaries next. 20 years ago tomorrow, July 1st, 1997, Great Britain handed control of the territory of Hong Kong to China. The Trumpet reported on this dramatic and prophetically significant act that demonstrated the fall of the once mighty British Empire. Well, what's happened in Hong Kong in the 20 years since then? For the answer to this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was just moments before midnight 20 years ago, tonight actually, that the British national anthem was blaring through the halls of Hong Kong's Convention Center Extension. And as it played, the Union Jack was lowered from the flagpole. And then, just as the song's final chord faded to silence, the clock struck midnight, a new day, and the musicians launched into China's national anthem, March of the Volunteers, and then they hoisted up that red five-star Chinese flag. So the United Kingdom's rule of Hong Kong was officially over at that time, and that very strategic territory that the British had placed under their flag 156 years earlier, and that they had transformed into just a beacon of prosperity and modernity, that was all handed from the fading empire to the world's most populous nation. And so it really was a historic day and a very historic event. And with that handover, three things happened. Chinese power was greatly multiplied. The people of Hong Kong took quite a hit, and basically the final act was performed in the closure of the British Empire.
So the Trumpet at that time, we talked a lot about this, drew a lot of attention to what happened here, and speculated about what would happen once China took over, once British influence receded. How did we do in our projections? You go back and look at what we said back in 1997.
Yes. Well, for the most part, we just called attention to how it marked the curtain really being drawn on the British Empire there. And I think that if you look at what's transpired in the 20 years since then, and just how the UK has become more and more irrelevant in geopolitics and in international relations since that time, I think that we could say that we were exactly right about that. And then we also just predicted that despite the fact that China promised Hong Kong that it would have a lot of autonomy and not necessarily be fully assimilated into China, that that Hong Kong, you know, it would sort of suffer to this authoritarian huge country, and it would be assimilated into it, and that autonomy that had distinguished it from the rest of China would rapidly erode. And in the 20 years since then, we've definitely seen all of that happen. It's also interesting that Hong Kong, you know, when China took over that, it not only assumed control of the world's third highest ranking center of global finance, but it also inherited this massive naval facility, a naval base that had been constructed there by the UK. And Hong Kong's location right at the juncture of the Pacific Ocean and the South China Sea gives that naval base specifically, and Hong Kong in general, immense strategic value, especially for someone who wants to control the South China Sea, which China, of course, does. Mm-hmm. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury highlighted this connection just in July of 2016. He said, Britain actually gave the South China Sea Prize of Hong Kong to China in 1997. And now that U.S. military presence in the area has been reduced, China is claiming the entire South China Sea as its own. So in retrospect, we see that handover really was a big piece of the puzzle that allowed China to make these modern moves toward claiming that huge, really vital piece of sea.
Very interesting. So just practically speaking, how much has life changed for Hong Kong's residents?
Well, at the time in 1997, China said, for 50 years, you guys can operate with a high degree of autonomy, and we won't meddle in your affairs. In the early years, that model was pretty carefully followed. But starting around 2014, China showed that it really has no intention of allowing Hong Kong to operate autonomously. That year, China said that for the upcoming election of Hong Kong's chief executive, which is basically the leader of Hong Kong, the people were only allowed to vote from a small pool of candidates that had been pre-approved by the Chinese government. Mm-hmm. So this is essentially democracy with Chinese characteristics, mm-hmm. which is not democracy at all. And Hong Kong, of course, they protested, but nothing came of it. And now they're led by a very Beijing-friendly chief executive. They've also had a lot of abductions of Hong Kong citizens by Chinese security agents, which was China had promised that wouldn't happen and that their security agencies would have no jurisdiction in Hong Kong. But China has obviously gone back on all that. So it's very obvious that Hong Kong is ruled essentially by Beijing at this point. And we're not even to the halfway point of that promised 50 years of autonomy.
Interesting to watch that. We appreciate you reminding us of that history and bringing us up to date on that. Another historic marker this month marked the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, the war in which the Jewish state of Israel defended itself against a coordinated attack by Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and other neighboring Arab countries. Israel captured East Jerusalem from Jordanian control, making the holy city undivided Jewish territory. So the Jews are celebrating this month. But there are many other countries who view it as the 50th anniversary of Israel's occupation of this territory. And there's been increasing pressure on Israel from the United Nations. It's using this milestone to try to increase that pressure. To learn more about this, we'll go back to Sam Livingston.
Thanks again. As you said, this is the 50-year anniversary of that war, and Israel held their celebration earlier this month. It's not a surprise that the Palestinians would call this an occupation or that they're marking 50 years of occupation. I think what's surprising is that they're using the United Nations as a platform to hold that celebration. So starting yesterday, they began a two-day forum. It started yesterday and then is going on today. It was organized by the Committee on the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, and this is being held in New York, at the United Nations headquarters. Israel was furious about this because there are two organizations that are taking part that were invited to this forum who are very closely tied to terrorist organizations. One of these groups is a supposed human rights group based right in Gaza. They have ties to a terror group called the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The former director of this group is a terrorist who has been jailed in Israel, and also this group recently claimed responsibility for killing an Israeli police officer last week. And then the other group that Israel is upset about who was invited to this forum is called Al-Mizan. Again, they say they're a human rights group, and they've done legal work for Hamas. So both Hamas and this Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine are recognized terror groups. They're being invited to the United Nations to hold this forum on the 50-year occupation of Palestine. So Israel, obviously, they're not happy about this at all. Their ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Dannon, said, "The UN is colluding with supporters of terror seeking to harm Israel. It is beyond comprehension that the UN funds are supporting organizations which aid terrorists and incite hate against Israel." I think the shocking part of this was he filed this complaint to the UN secretary. They were just going off about how you can't have, you know, these terrorist groups coming in here. And then they didn't hear back from the UN secretary for quite a while. And then they issued the statement that said, because the secretary didn't initiate this forum and because it was organized by the members, the secretary can't do anything about it. You have to file this complaint with the Committee on the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People. So Israel's getting nowhere. These terrorists are invited to the United Nations, and it really just enforces, you know, the uselessness of the United Nations other than its ability to do things that go against Israel. And again, it highlights Israel being alienated on the global stage, that it can't even get this supposed organization that the United Nations is supposed to be for the good of mankind, can't even tell them, you know, don't invite terrorists into your building. Mm-hmm. Again, that's just what the United Nations, that's the only thing they've really been able to accomplish in the past decades is how do we go against Israel?
Right. Yeah, it's hard not to view this in light of, say, the declaration that it made at the end of last year that mm-hmm. was in support of a Palestinian state and drawing the line through Palestinian territory. We did an infographic on that in the Trumpet magazine. But for them to basically say, we're not responsible, we're right. washing our hands of this. This is all taking place outside the jurisdiction of the Secretary General's office is quite an extraordinary statement. We appreciate that, Sam. Well, we're going to now conclude with a couple of economic stories. The first is out of Europe, which seems to be the world leader in bureaucratic regulation and red tape. This past Tuesday, the European Commission leveled its largest fine ever on a company. It accused the search engine giant Google of unfairly promoting its own products on internet searches over those of its competitors. Why the ultra-tough crackdown for this? We're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is a record fine to follow on from the previous record fine, which was on Intel, following on from another previous record fine before that, that was on Microsoft. So you might be able to, you might be starting to see a pattern emerging here. EU slapping multi-billion fines on American tech companies. And I mean, that's really been the joke for some years now. Every time the European Union's budget gets a bit low, you just go and sue Microsoft to top it up. And as you said, the reasons they gave for this was that Google was more predominantly displaying their shopping results, which they said was abuse of their dominant market position. Google does have a dominant position in the search market. And
although it is important to say that nobody has to use Google.
No, absolutely. I mean,
the European Commission is defining this sort of monopoly quite narrowly in order to justify taking this kind of action.
Yes, I mean, I think America, has similar protections on abusing dominant market position. I think the theory is kind of sound in that you can see a theoretical need to protect, you know, say somebody owns all of the phone lines in the United States, you don't want them to unfairly advantage their own pizza companies.
Right.
By giving free phone calls and making phone calls to all their rivals expensive. But absolutely, in practice, I mean, I've seen the number of people I've seen, and I completely agree, saying, you know, this law is in place to make things better for consumers, and it's very easy to see how the EU's ruling actually makes things worse. It's going to affect me. And you can see actually already Google in the European Union works worse than Google outside the European Union because of data protection laws. I already try to connect fairly regularly via Google, making it look like I'm coming from the United States, so I don't have a certain results hidden because of EU data protection laws. Hmm. And now your experience is worse because of this. It actually, as a consumer, I find that Google does me a favor by putting their shopping results up the top there, because when I'm looking to buy something, Google's price comparison works better than anybody else's that I've tried. If somebody else did a better one, I'd just go there. So yeah, they're not protecting consumers here at all, which is what the law is designed to do. It's just yet another excuse to sock it to an American tech company. And I don't think I've seen any journalist anywhere saying that consumers are going to be better off because of this ruling, when, you know, consumers are the reason why these laws exist in the first place. And of course, that doesn't mean anything in Europe. Instead, they kind of take these rules and twist them to try and instead use them to protect European companies from competition from American-backed tech companies.
Well, that's an excellent point, that the effects of these really do tend to go against their intended use. So what is it that, I mean, you basically implied it there. What are the European regulators trying to accomplish here?
Yeah, I think it is quite clear that they are going after tech companies. And, you know, this is, Mr. Ron Fraser, he had an article on this some years ago after the Intel fine called Europe's Beastly Fines. And he wrote that anyone who seeks to understand the EU's agenda should realize the long-term strategy that has been in place since its inception, a strategy to destroy the Anglo-American economies and place their post-war dominance with a European imperial power having its economic and political hub in Berlin, its bureaucracy in Brussels, and its spiritual headquarters in Rome. And that's exactly what's going on here. You know, Europe, they've managed to muscle their way into a whole load of different areas, but America dominates the technology sector.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's almost no European equivalents to any of these. You know, you go online, where do you go to do your shopping online? You go to Amazon. Where do you go to do your searching? You go to Google. And it really bothers people in Europe, and especially in the European Commission, in the European Union, because they think this way, that Europe does not have there's no European Google.
Mm-hmm.
There are, I think you can find a handful of tech firms that I think might be, I'm trying to think whether something like Spotify, I think I've got a feeling that might have emerged out of a European country, but they're the exception, not the rule. And instead of saying, okay, well, what's the cause of this? And looking at the root causes and saying, well, actually in America, it is possible to start a company in your garage and grow it mm-hmm. to become a major multinational. And that is absolutely impossible in Europe, with the possible exception of the UK that has slightly looser laws than the rest of the mainland. You know, they're not looking at that. And instead it's, you know, treat the effects. Okay, so you see this across Europe. You see it in France. Okay, Amazon, you're not allowed to offer free delivery because you're putting French book companies out of business. And so Amazon says, well, okay, we're offering 1 euro cent delivery now. Mm-hmm. But it's that thinking. And so they don't dominate this. They're very jealous of it. It's also, you know, Mr. Trump, they want to hit back at Donald Trump. He's had a lot of run-ins with American tech companies. So I think it's a way that they can strike at America without necessarily getting a whole bunch of retaliation from Donald Trump. This has been going through long before he came along, but it's probably that adds to the impetus to find a way to hurt America. But it's jealousy at America, and it's wanting to establish European dominance of the economy. And this is a crucial sector of the economy. And the only way to do that is to just repeatedly whack American companies.
Well, we appreciate that, Richard. We're going to just move right into another similar story of unintended economic consequences of bad policy. There's been a concerted effort in the United States to increase minimum wage laws to much higher levels than they've been historically. And there have been laws passed in certain areas. The city of Seattle raised its minimum wage to a very handsome $15 an hour. Of course, this is supposed to be a big benefit to entry-level workers. But as an understanding of basic economics would tell you, the results of these kind of policies don't tend to match the intentions. A recent report shows this is what's going on in Seattle. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, there's many states and many cities that have been trying to bump up their minimum wage recently. And you may have even seen on the news, especially like the Fight for 15 campaigns when amongst the fast food workers talking to try to get their minimum wage up to $15. But Seattle, Washington's really been kind of like one of the main labs that we can actually see the effects of how this is going to work out. They're in the process of bumping their wage up to $15 an hour. In 2015, they bumped it from $9.47 up to $11 an hour. And then just last year, they bumped it from $11 to $13. And the city's legally obligated to bump it from $13 to $15 before 2021 rolls around.
Mm-hmm.
But just in the year since they bumped it from that $11 to $13, that's almost a 20% increase on your hourly rate.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a study to find that amongst most of the industries that pay that rate, you've cut workers' hours back almost 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time they do the math, they say like the average low-income worker in these areas is actually receiving $125 less dollars a week than they were before the wage increase.
Just because of hours being true.
Right. They're obviously working less, but they're getting less money net because their work not the companies, they're not turning a profit being able to let them work their full work week like they were before.
Mm-hmm. $125 a week, that's quite a bit of change.
Especially for someone who's only making $13. I mean, that's like a 25% demotion or 25% cut to your weekly wages. Mm. And yeah, this is just really just kind of an example of something where people, I mean, even if they have good intentions, being like, okay, well, we want to help low-income people by making a decree that they have to pay them so much. But just like in physics, there are laws of gravity and laws of thermodynamics and economics. There are laws that govern that. And the two most powerful laws of economics are supply and demand. And it just, according to those laws, if you artificially raise a price, well, then more people are going to want that job. So demand goes up, but less people can afford to pay that price. So supply goes down. And as would be predicted, more people competing for the same, for the fewer, a fewer number of jobs, you're either going to get hours laid off or you're going to get or either people laid off or people's hours cut back.
Mm-hmm. Or I guess looked at another way, just to to arbitrarily tell a business that we say that this particular job that you are offering is worth this amount of money, whether or not that reflects economic reality. Maybe according to them, it's only worth $7 or $8 an hour. They would gladly hire somebody to do that job at $7 or $8 an hour. The government says, no, it's worth $15. And so then they have to find other ways to make sure that they're breaking even or that they're making a profit. So they either have to trim the hours or cut the position or have one person doing two jobs or whatever it might be in order to make sure that their bottom line reflects reality.
Right. And you've definitely seen that in other countries like in Australia that have already implemented some of these minimum wage laws for fast food workers on a nationwide basis to where their fast food industry is much more automated now. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of, you pay with a kiosk, you've got a lot of like machines that automatically flip burgers, and then so, and you'll pay the supervisors who take care of those machines the higher wage, but you only need half the amount of people you used to.
Right. Well, there should be enough evidence that the politicians are going down the wrong road by mandating these higher minimum wage laws, but I guess the political gain that they have from it is too great to resist.
Right. And that is actually just a good thing for people to remember is that they keep talking like low minimum wage people is this huge nationwide scourge, but only 2% of Americans over the age of 25 actually make minimum wage. And even those people, if they're showing to work on time and working, they get promoted relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. So usually these minimum wage laws, instead of actually just helping people who are poor, is they price them out of the market to where you can't even get your foot in the door to start that process.
Right.
And so it's, I mean, there are a lot of scriptures in the Bible about the workman being worthy of his hire and treating the poor and the needy fairly. But policies like this actually do the exact opposite of that by not even letting them get started in the job market. I mean, how are you going to ever be promoted if you can't get an entry-level job in the beginning part because people can't afford to pay you $15 for a skill set you don't have yet?
Right. Oh, well, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com. The stories that we've talked about on the program today are mostly posted on article form on that website. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines from this past week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Jeremiah.
Japan announced on Wednesday that for the first time, it is determined to put a man on the moon. So far, Japan's Aerospace Exploration Agency has only ever sent astronauts to the International Space Station. But now a plan is in the works to go far beyond that and to land some of these astronauts on the moon. The announcement marks just the latest in a series of really ambitious space exploration plans by a lot of different Asian nations. And this rising competition for space-related prestige is really beginning to resemble the competition that we saw in the Cold War space race of the mid-20th century.
All right, we'll go now to Richard.
Germany's parliament voted today to legalize homosexual marriage. It's the final day of Germany's legislative agenda before they take a break for the summer, and then they've got their elections right after that. So it's something they placed a very high priority on slotting in there before the elections, and it comes after a change of course in German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who previously opposed such a vote, but this time said that she was happy for her MPs to vote with their conscience on the issue.
All right, we'll go now to Andrew.
Planet Earth's debt levels have surged to $217 trillion in the first quarter of this year. That's a 320% of the world's total economic output. The United States alone accounts for $20 trillion, almost 10% of this figure. Yet the third world has probably increasing their debt levels at the fastest, increasing $3 trillion in debt in the last quarter, up to $56 trillion total. This situation is leading many nations like China, Russia, and Germany to hoard gold as insurance against a possible breakdown of the Western monetary system.
All right, we'll go now to Sam.
Syria fired rockets into the Golan Heights region last night, over into the also into Israeli territory. Israel returned fire. They bombed the mortars, supposedly where the rockets were fired from. It's believed that this was just a byproduct of the ongoing civil war there in Syria. But again, this shows how close a major conflict is creeping up onto the Israeli border there.
Okay, back to Richard.
Britain's Conservatives agreed a confidence and supply agreement with the Democratic Unionist Party on Monday. That means that the unionists are agreeing to support them in Parliament. And part of this agreement included an extra £1 billion of spending for Northern Ireland. It included making sure pension spending doesn't go down. Basically, a lot more spending. And you know, this points to Britain contributing to that debt total that Andrew just talked about. Britain's debt is already at its highest level since 1966. And it seems that even the Conservatives now, Britain's party of austerity, have been completely forced to abandon bringing that debt under control.
Okay, back to Andrew.
On Monday, the United States Supreme Court announced that it would hear the case Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. They'll hear this case this fall, and it concerns an incident where a Colorado baker refused to decorate a wedding cake for a homosexual couple. The baker's argument is that even though he would have willingly sold the couple any other item in his store, he couldn't decorate their cake without violating his religious beliefs against homosexual marriage. This court case looks like it will be a close one, with possibly Justice Anthony Kennedy coming down as the deciding vote this fall, and will have far-reaching implications on the future of religious freedom in the United States.
Okay, back to Jeremiah for one last item.
China has just broken ground on the world's first forest city. This is in Gangxi province, and the plan is for about 30,000 people to live there, and all of the buildings will be covered with plants and trees. The entire city will be powered by geothermal and solar energy, and besides not really producing new pollution, the city will also absorb about 10,000 tons of CO2 and about 57 tons of fine dust pollution every year. So the whole thing is slated to be finished in just 3 years, and if it ends up looking like the artist's projections, it'll be a really beautiful city that's just unlike anything that's ever been built before.
Very cool. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on the program today. You can give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Sam Livingston, and Richard Palmer.
Always a pleasure. Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Steve Herkus. And I'll leave you with the words of Oliver Wendell Holmes. We need education in the obvious more than investigation of the obscure. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.